Today is Sunday, September 11th, 2022. This is part 34 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart. Jim's last name is spelled H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
Doing great, Tom. Just a little bit of a congestion, so you may hear that in the tape, but doing well otherwise.
Okay, glad to hear it. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes, please.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Last time, I think you left us off in the fall of 2017 with another hike into the Juno and Jupiter areas. Can you pick that thread up for us?
Yeah. So we, Art and I, had been into... tried Juno and Jupiter the year before, and that we had planned to do that, and the temperature had become quite excessive at that time, and so we bagged it basically, and we talked about that a couple of sessions ago.
Yeah.
That trip and how it was disappointing in the sense that we couldn't make it up. So, you know, we kept trying to get back there and hoping to do so. And so in October, the plan was definitely we're going to do it this time. And we were also going to do, after Juno and Jupiter, we figured we'd do a couple days and grab Vishnu. So, it was a pretty nice plan, very elegant, all contained there on the North Rim. And it would have been my 98th, 99th, and 100th summit being Vishnu. You know, it's a perfect, perfect trio, right? So, but that was the plan, and as we know, plans typically go awry, but, you know, not in a bad way. So, anyways, I flew down to Vancouver. I'm sorry, from Vancouver to Phoenix, as usual, and Art and I then did our basic business in town, getting supplies and whatnot, and then drove up to the North Rim in the morning of the 8th of October. And the first thing we did was we went to the backcountry office and picked up a permit for the hike. You know, we got into good habits after after meeting the ranger there on the Nanquit Trail a few years prior. So we got the permit for this to allow us to do some hiking. Well, to do the hiking down and then the camping below the rim, right? Mm-hmm. For the three summits. And so by around, you know, mid morning, we were heading out to Cape Final, and we'd parked Arts and Praise there at the parking lot for Cape Final. And you know, that Cape Final is, for me, it's a very it's one of the most fascinating of the routes into the canyon. And the only reason I can point to that is because I can think of that for that reason, the way it affects me is because I read about it when I was a student at University of Arizona, and I would, we've talked about this, I would go into the special collections and I would check out Harvey Butchert's notes,
right.
And at that time you couldn't even photocopy things; you had to transcribe things
by hand,
which I did. And I remember reading Harvey's description in the '60s of when they first found this route off Cape Final. It took some effort. And it was just such a tremendous long distance of unsurmountable cliff, you know, from basically from Etoko Point or Nagy Point all the way around to Cape Royal there. And I don't know, for some reason I always really had a thing for the Cape Final route. Plus there's rappels on it, and I just thought it was really neat. And Art and I had been down this a couple times already, so it wasn't anything new, but nonetheless it still gave me that excitement to walk out to the woods towards the top of the route. So anyways, we got out there and we found the route down, no problem this time because we'd been there already before. There's a nice rappel, as we talked about. Harvey, I think, used to do it in two rappels, so we just did it in one long rappel. Mm. And then there's a nice little climb down where people have placed a fixed rope, so that gives you a nice handhold to get you down the final little drop there to the base of the Coconino. So we did that in fairly short order, and headed down with our packs towards the saddle between Juno and the Cape Final Rim. And so, you know, it's easy, fairly easy going, particularly in October when it's a lot cooler than it was in May the first time we tried this. And so we got down to the saddle there in the mid-afternoon and figured out we were going to camp. And then I decided at that point that I would head up Juneau to try and do it that afternoon.
Okay.
And Art's interested in going on the hikes, but he's not that interested in the summit. So he said, go right ahead. He could sit there in the saddle and just watch me go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And because you do have a good view from the saddle.
Hmm.
So basically, I just, around 4:30 in the afternoon, headed over to there's a gully that you can see at the south end of Juneau that basically goes through much of the Supai. And it's a straightforward slog once you get past the initial cliffs in the gully. So I went up that, and by 90 minutes after leaving camp, I was on the summit.
Wow.
And I didn't spend much time there because it was getting late in the day, and I didn't want to get too caught out in the dark. So I reversed the route with the difference that I followed the ridge south, the summit ridge, to the south, to the very top of the gully that I had started up, and went down from there directly. So when I'd come up, I went up the gully and worked through the first series of cliffs. There's some minor climbing in there. It's straightforward third class, but a little exposed. And then once I got above those, I kind of headed up north out of the gully to try and reduce the hiking time and distance to the summit. But I think the best route to do is to just go straight up to the ridge and avoid all the difficulties. So that's the way I came down, and it went really smooth. So it was fun to get that summit after so many, many tries and so many, many years. So
nice.
Congrats. Thanks. So I headed down back to the camp, and Art and I, you know, had a nice relaxed night there, in contemplating the next morning. And so in the early morning, we woke up, and Art decided he didn't want to do Jupiter either. And so, no problem, you know, it doesn't bother me. And so, I left him and I started up, and I kind of repeated the start of the route I'd done the afternoon before for Juneau, to get through the first Supai cliffs, because I knew that route went. And then from there, I followed laterally, horizontally, working my way up through the cliffs when I could. Now, when Art and I had tried this a couple years prior in the heat of May, he and I had left the saddle and gone low along the top of the red wall towards the to the south until we got fairly far along and could kind of start heading directly up to the saddle between Jupiter and Juneau directly. And that went, you know, that was fine. There's nothing wrong with that route, but it is straightforward in the sun and very intense. So this route, I think, was a little bit quicker and gave you more shade because I was in and out of behind trees and whatnot on those Supai ledges. So anyways, that's the way I went up. And as I worked my way south, I got finally onto the ridge between Juneau and Jupiter, and I realized I was actually a couple of cliff bands above the level of the notch between the two summits, and I needed to get down.
Uh-huh.
So it's not a problem, right? Not a problem. There's plenty of ways to go, and you just walk along until you find the right break that you can handle, and you scramble down. And so by this time, I finally had reached the level of the saddle, or actually just one Supai ledge below, and was on the east side of the ridge. And so at this point, I was well positioned for the climb of Jupiter, and you start out and you head to the south along the ridge crest on the east side of the ridge, and immediately there's a big prow of Supai, and you walk along the base of that cliff and with a nice overhanging roof way up above you, and And then you start to tackle the Supai bands. And it was really, I remember it being really a lot of back and forth challenging route finding, you know. And I find that stuff lots of fun because you start up a cliff face or in a gully, and then you realize, you know, it's not going to go. And so you got to back down, and you go along, and you find another opportunity, and you try that. And, oh, yeah, this one goes. And then you have, if you pop off to the left on this ledge, you can get around this corner. And, you know, it's a series of misses, tries and misses. And and I remember having to do multiple, you know, back and forth, up and down attempts to try and work out the route. And, of course, once you get far enough along, then you realize, you know, you're remembering all these things, these moves that you've made, and hoping you can keep them straight. And this is why we sometimes put cairns here and there, right, when it gets really complicated and or you need to know the key spot.
Right.
So eventually, though, there was a I worked my way along a ledge to the south, and there was this beautiful little gully. Well, I called it a slot gully. It was the key to the climb, and you know, it just entailed some hand and feet scrambling, and I was on top of that, and so that was the worst of the route finding. It was just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
So at that point, then I could just kind of I was back into the open sunshine and the fall day, and so I continued south along the ridge and gradually ascending up towards the summit of Jupiter, and then just below the highest Supai band, I went to the west and followed along until there was an obvious break, could get up through the rest of the Supai, and then the Coconino looks a little imposing, but if you follow along the west side, you eventually come to an area where the cross stratification in the sandstone of the Coconino basically develops into a series of downsloping, south-facing downsloping ledges, right, that are based or developed in this cross stratification. And it's really fun to scramble up this. It's like a series of steps. I mean, big, giant steps because they're ledges. And of course, sometimes the sandstone slabs are a little loose because they're weathering, and all those little sand grains are kind of eroding, and you run the risk of having big slabs kind of start cascading off. But that didn't happen, and if you're careful, it's not a problem. And so, you know, I was able to work my way up this south facing gully on these down dipping ledges. Just lots of fun, and there were some reptile footprints in there too.
Oh, cool!
In the sand, so that's always fun to run into that kind of stuff in the Coconino. And then at the top of that was pretty much the end of the difficulties. There was a little bit of a head wall at the top, and I put a cairn there because from above you couldn't really see where, you know, this exit came up, and so I didn't want to miss it and spend a lot of time casting about. So I put a cairn there and then headed for the summit. And it was wonderful. You know, just a great, great view from up there. It would have been a lot more fun if my friend had been up there. But that's the way it is sometimes. You know, you take what you can get. So, but anyways, it was my 98th and 99th summits. And very satisfying. But, of course, we had Vishnu coming up. So that was even more enticing here coming up in the following days. So after suitable time on the summit there, I reversed the route, went back down to the notch, and then dropped down directly from the notch between Juno and Jupiter directly down through the Supai to the lowest Supai ledge, and went back to visit Art. And at that point, Art had decided he really didn't feel up to doing Vishnu. And so I don't know whether it was the heat or what, but it wasn't too hot, and certainly not like, you know, the year and a half before when we'd been in there. But it was a little warm, let's put it that way.
Okay.
So for whatever reason, we decided we wouldn't do Vishnu, and we'd take our time getting out of the canyon, and and then figure out something else to do. So eventually we rested in this saddle, and I think we talked about this a couple of episodes ago when Art and I had been down there the first time, the tremendous geological throw of the strata that's represented on that saddle, because you have the strand. Well, there's a significant fault that runs through that Unkar Creek Lava Creek saddle, and throws the rocks, or brings the rocks on the east side of the saddle up much higher than those on the west, or maybe it's the other way around, but I can't recall. I'd have to think about it more closely. But the fault offset is really dramatic and appreciable, and you can see it right there, right? Because you're sitting there in the saddle, your head is basically at the contact between the red wall and the supai, and then if you look across the other side, you can see that contact, you know, like 100 feet offset from your head. So, yeah, very impressive geological spot, so it's fun to hang out there and contemplate that and what that meant, but eventually we headed back up, and we had figured to take our time, but we decided to go to the rim and sleep in the cool of the forest. So that's what we did. We reversed the route all the way up to the rim, and then hiked back on the trail there towards our vehicle. And at some point there, we went off the trail and camped in the woods, because we didn't want to, you know, camp at our vehicle or whatever, get into that part of the park. So yeah, it was a nice a nice satisfying evening under the ponderosas, and so it was disappointing, I guess, that we weren't going to do Vishnu, but Art suggested, he said, I've got a good alternate, and I said, what do you think? What do you think? And he said, how about let's try Cogswell Butte? You know where Cogswell is, out there in the Thunder River area, right? And to me, it sounded like a great option, because I'd always been fascinated with that area. It's of course part of the Esplanade region that Art and I spent decades literally exploring in great detail, and I'd also hiked past it as a youngster when I did my big month-long solo hike through the Grand Canyon on the North Rim. I'd hiked past it and seen Cogswell Butte, and was familiar with it and seen it many times. Plus, it's very, very interesting geologically, being a big fault block of red wall limestone that has been down dropped on the south side of some faults. So we figured, yeah, let's go for that. So we had our permit to cover us for in the canyon hiking. So we drove back and cleaned up, and then drove out to the Monument Point trailhead, where the Bill Hall Trail starts down.
Right.
And we parked the car there, and then headed down that trail. And I hadn't been down that for many, many years, since the early '80s when I used it to access Thunder River on a hike I did with a friend down there, just a couple day hike down to Thunder River. So I kind of forgotten a lot about the trail and how well it's laid out. And in fact, we started down, and you go down and you follow along, you go down through the Kaibab or the uppermost parts of the Kaibab, and you follow kind of horizontally to the south, and then around a point, and then you're slowly descending, and then you actually proceed for quite a distance to the northwest, semi-horizontally, until you can get to a suitable break
through the
rest of the Kaibab and Coconino. And so at this point, we encountered this group of kids. They were like 12-year-olds. It was really impressive. Huh. There were like 25 of them, you know. And I guess they were organized. They seemed to have a leader, which was like an older kid. But it was very peculiar because, typically you see older parents, I guess, somewhere in the vicinity. And these kids didn't, they seemed to be on their own, you know.
Were they doing a day hike or were they doing a backpack?
No, they had packs. They definitely had packs and they were coming up. So they had spent time down. I assume they went to Thunder River, right? And
But 25 of them, I mean, the maximum
group size
is 11.
Really
what were they doing?
Yeah, it was really surprising. Huh. You know, even Sierra Club trips are like 10, I think, or 12, and I think they're usually all adults. So it was just very surprising, and we got a laugh out of it, you know. I mean, we didn't spend a lot of time talking to these kids and quizzing them or anything like that, but we just kind of marveled at it as they, you know, we kind of stepped aside as they kind of all clambered by, and with all their different types of clothing and different types of packs, and it was just very, very comical, and so we appreciated that, and so after they left, we continued down, and the Bill Hall Trail then joins the Thunder River Trail, right? Which actually starts over at Indian Hollow. And it's the old way that one used to go to get to Thunder River before the Bill Hall Trail was put in the 70s. And I think the Bill Hall Trail had been there. It just wasn't used. And so it wasn't used very much by hikers in lieu of the Monument Point Trail. So we dropped some water there because we knew we'd be coming back. And then we just leisurely followed the Esplanade around to the Red Wall. And at that point, the top of the Red Wall, we thought, well, let's drop our packs here. We'll camp here, and although it was afternoon, and we'll go down and do Cogswell now, and then come back up in the late afternoon and camp here, and then we'll have a leisurely return to the rim the next day. So that's exactly what we did, and we dropped our packs well off the trail, but to the west of the drop. I mean, it was close enough that you could hear people if they walked by, but because of the hoodoos and the topography, nobody saw anybody, right? So we were well out of sight there. So so we dropped our packs there and then headed down the Monument Point Trail through the Red Wall and then down basically to the trail that goes from Deer Creek to Pete's Creek,
right,
to Thunder River. And there's a river runner trail there, as you must know very well, and through Surprise Valley. So we then headed southwest, and you could see the route up Cogswell. It's very, very straightforward, right?
Yes.
You work your way up a talus slope of Red Wall, and there's some big fault blocks of Supai sandstone at the top of that. You work your way over those and then continue up the last of the Red Wall slide. And then you're at basically the summit ridge. And so, again, it had spectacular views up there. And we signed into the Art Light Register. I think this was the first time that we had actually visited a summit now that already had one of Art's registers put out on it by Sean Peters, who had done it. He had put it out, I think, in July of that year. So, you know, I've talked a little bit about Art's registers, and I think you should talk to him and do an interview about this because it's kind of extraordinary what he's done is, you know, he's taken the initiative to produce these copper registers for climbing logs. And they're all essentially the same size, a box about 4x6x1.5 or 2. And he puts in, you know, a notebook and a pencil and all in a plastic bag. And so people can record their ascents. And by this time, by now, you know, 2022, I think he's pretty much got them everywhere. Because he's not only did he and I put out a few but he would give them to all the other hiking colleagues that he knows, and in particular, Sean Peters and Jake Daly have put out, I think, the lion's share.
Okay.
But anyways, it was kind of neat to see one already on a summit, you know, as opposed to having, because we'd been lugging them up for a few years and putting them out, and here was one already there, so we could, you know, quickly open it up and sign in. And the other thing, too, that Art is trying to do with these registers, he's trying to, you know, provide a better container for the residual materials that previous climbers left to record their ascents. You know, sometimes these are really fragmentary, rotting pieces of paper if they were left in the 60s by Harvey Butchert or, you know, somebody. So,
right.
You know, that Art then would put that into one of his little plastic bags, Ziplocs in the register to try and enhance their longevity. So anyways, it was a lot of fun, and Art told me about Raymond Cogswell, who the butte was named for, and he was the photographer, a young fellow, I guess, on the 1909 Stone, Julius Stone expedition, and pretty impressive that that this fellow got this particular butte named after himself, because it's very much out there, you know, it's very prominent, and I won't say remote, but everybody who floats the river sees this, right, and many people hike up it, so it's kind of a lucky thing for him that.
Do you know the backstory of that naming?
You know, I maybe that's why I raised it, because I thought there might be, and I seem to have a recollection, but I can't.
I think, and I could be wrong, I haven't researched this 100% yet, but I think that Galloway and Stone and Dubendorf all got names, but but Stone didn't like Cogswell.
Oh, really?
Stone hired Cogswell to be the photographer, and I got to be careful. I mean, this is your interview here. And he did not get along well, and he got left off in the naming party. Marston came in and worked with BOG to get that butte name for Cogswell.
Well, that's a great story.
Yeah.
That's a great story, and that's a credit to Marston, too, right? He was just as much a part of the expedition as anybody.
Absolutely,
else.
And he took thousands of photographs, which was the whole point of Stone's trip. And they were really good pictures too. So, yeah.
Well, I hope you write that up somewhere. That would be a neat little thing to reference.
Yeah,
you know?
It's a fun little story. But it's a beautiful butte, like you say. It's a wonderful climb.
And you know, I have to talk about the geology, because it's so significant there, and part of the reason they call the area Surprise Valley, which is the small valley that's between, say, Cogswell Butte and the ridge between Bonita and Tepetz Creek, and then the red wall to the north is part of the reason. Well, the main reason, I guess, is because there's a surprise drainage to it. You don't really see that drainage from most areas. But if you follow down, it does drain to the south, out of kind of an unexpected or unseen flow area, right? So I've always assumed that was the name for it. But it's very interesting geologically, because the whole valley is essentially formed in talus of a significant landslide that came off the red wall slopes to the north. And you know, you can see these red wall blocks that have been moved down the slope of the fault plain to the south, and with chunks of Supai sandstone still, you know, sitting or stratigraphically contiguous with the red wall, and that is all offset by several hundred feet from the true stratigraphic contact, which is seen on the wall of the the Redwall Wall of the Valley to the north. So just a very impressive area, and it's called the Lystrick Fault, or basically like a gravity slide fault.
Hmm,
so,
right.
So basically, you know, the Redwall was undermined from the south, and as erosion was taking place on the river, and so the supporting cliff face lost its support, and these huge blocks of red wall with supai on top, you know, slid down and came to their new position. And
so there's an argument that goes that the first USGS map of that area has Surprise Valley labeled in the Deer Creek drainage. You can't see it from the river. And it only was when people scrambled up there from the river that they found this big valley full of, you know, this wonderful creek with water in it, that valley, the Deer Creek Valley, was Surprise Valley. And then eventually that name got shifted to where you're talking about, between to Pete's Creek and Deer Creek.
Wow, another great story.
It's a crazy little bit of map-making history there.
Yeah, and so that shows up, you know, that's recognizable on the earliest topographic maps.
Yeah.
They've got Deer Creek Valley labeled as Surprise Valley.
Crazy stuff.
Very, very, very neat. You know, there's a book waiting to be written about all these kinds of little stories.
Well,
tales,
hope you can do it.
You know? Well, this is going to have to take some collaboration, Tom, because you've got all the information.
I'm a free giver. Take it away.
Okay, all right. Well, I may follow up on that for sure. That's a very interesting little story, and that explains a lot. So the name basically evolves from the discovery that there was an actual creek up there, after all, or major valley, I guess.
Yeah.
And but it's interesting they shifted it. But
yeah.
Oh, well, we're going to talk about some other shifting names here in a little bit, I think. If my cold doesn't get the better of me. So, so anyways, it was a fun little summit. A lot of fun. I mean, it's great when you're not under pressure to get these summits.
Right.
You know, and you can do these hikes and relax and enjoy the scenery and talk with your colleagues and friends and take your time, right? And so that's kind of what we were doing.
Nice.
We were able to kind of take a nice relaxed walk back up the Redwall Trail to our camp area at the top of the Redwall, where we had a nice cool evening and relaxed there. So the next day we basically headed back up the trail to where the Bill Hall Trail came down.
Yep.
And we had stashed water there, so we drank that. And at this point I told Art, look, I've never hiked, Art, the stretch of trail here from where we are over to the trailhead
of the Thunder River Trail.
Thunder River Trail, yeah, because I've just never done that. And I'd come down from the trailhead in Indian Hollow. I'd come down the trail at the start and then gone to the south and southwest, you know, to get out to Fishtail Mesa and Cranberry Canyon and all that, but never hiked that stretch of Esplanade. So we agreed that he would head up the Bill Hall and then I would hike the Thunder River Trail, which I did, and it was quite enjoyable. Lots of mezcal pits. It's a pleasant ramble. Much more up and down than I expected, though.
Yep.
You know, because Art and I had spent so many weeks hiking Esplanade out on the Great Thumb area, and also in Fishtail Mesa area, and et cetera. And there you can do a lot of quick travel. If you're so inclined, you can do it quickly because the hiking is just so much like sidewalks. So it's a little bit different on the monument. The Thunder River Trail, because it's just more up and down.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it, but it was fun, right? It's always great to have a trail there. So.
Yeah.
So anyways, when I came up the trail to Indian Hollow, hiked into the campground there at the end of the road, And Art was waiting for me. He'd gone up, gotten his car, and then driven it around to save me that walk.
So, cool.
That was pretty nice.
Yeah.
So yeah. So anyways, at that point, that was kind of it. And you know, we had our standard drive back to the North Rim Lodge and Jacob's Lake, and have our our burgers and whatnot, and then drove back down to Phoenix. So it was a little disappointing not to have gotten Vishnu as number 100, but I did get to number 100, right?
Right.
With Cogswell. And,
right.
And so it was very, very satisfying nonetheless. And yeah, pretty nice, a nice trip overall. So, yeah, so that was a fun October. And how are we doing on time here? Got enough, I guess, if you want to keep talking.
I do if you do.
Yeah, sure. Why not? Let's do it. So the next trip, I mean, have you got questions or anything like that?
No, we're good.
Okay,
Where did you do then?
Yeah, so I flew back to Vancouver, and we kind of did our thing, Art and I, you know. It's interesting because I realized here today when I was reviewing these notes that we're getting to the point of time where my mother passed away, and so reviewing the notes, I realized I didn't make any comments about that initially until. And so I kind of thought, well, why was that? And I realized, well, it's because the notes are generated right away, you know, after a trip. And so if something subsequent hasn't happened yet, of course, it's not going to be commented upon in the notes. And the notes are mostly for the trip. But anyways, so the next trip I took was hopefully going to be with Art, but Art didn't make it on this one. And multiple reasons for that. Number one is I finally had found a partner who wanted to do some climbing, a younger partner, and who was very interested in going after Charybdis Butte.
Huh.
And I'll talk about Mark in a few minutes, but Art in the winter of 2018 he was in a car wreck. And his Impreza was totaled.
Oh, wow.
And he had some major damage to his leg. And so for quite some time, he had to, to care for that. And it kind of precluded any hiking. So in the spring of 2018, when I wanted to do this hike, he was laid up. He couldn't hike at all, right, because he was kind of confined to a scooter.
Wow, yeah.
Yeah, with his legs pointing out straight. And you know, Art being an engineer or having an engineering bent, let's put it that way, figured out how to adapt at life, no problem, right? And he was very systematic about it and doing everything right to keep his recovery on track. So it was just as well because he didn't want to do any climbing, serious technical climbing. And by the time I talked Mark into being able to come down to Phoenix, it was fairly late in the spring. So Mark Coleman, not sure I've mentioned him before, but seems like I have. Mm. But in any event, he was working with the Geological Survey of Canada.
Okay. You did. You mentioned him.
Yeah. Okay. And so you know, he and I got on quite well, and I think I did say this last time about, you know, after the Granitica Symposium in Flagstaff that was held about Grand Canyon climbing, I was asked to kind of give the talk that I gave at the symposium to my office in Vancouver, my office of the Geological Survey. And so there were about 15 or 20 people that participated in that or attended that. And I pretty much gave the same talk. And Mark, this young fellow, was in attendance, and he came up to me afterwards, and he said, and I hadn't really met him at that point. He was working in our office, but, you know, typically when you're working in our office, you're up in the Yukon somewhere, right? Or, you know, in the Arctic, or you're not in the office. And so he and I started chatting, and he said, boy, I really love what this kind of style of adventure. And, you know, I had talked in the Granitica Symposium and also in my presentation to the GSC about how Grand Canyon climbing is so much effort for so little climbing, you know. And you can spend days and walk dozens of miles just to get in place to do 150 feet of rock climbing, and it'd be pretty pretty junky rock, you know, but there's still a mystique and an aura that attracts people to this. And so, and obviously, right, for those of us who are into it, that's what draws us. And it turns out Mark is very much that kind of a personality. He's 30 years younger than me, so it's kind of an interesting combination of 35. I mean, he might be insulted if I was saying this. But anyways, he said, look, if you want to go on a trip, I'd be happy to go with you. And I said, well, I've got this climb that I'd like to do, and I've been thinking about Crib Dispute for many, many years. And so I talked him into it, and we decided to do this in May. So Crib Dispute is it's on the Tonto platform just between Crystal and Tuna Creek. At least this is my assessment. So if it's not mapped, actually, on any of the major USGS topos. It's not plotted there.
Right.
And basically, when I had gone through here in 74, I believe it was, on my long North Rim trip, I walked right underneath the south side of Crib Dispute. I walked around it on the Tonto. And at one point, you know, you're sitting in many places. When you're right next to the butte, you can look to the southwest, and you're looking right across at Scylla Butte.
Right.
So on the opposite side of the river, and Scylla is very well placed. Everybody knows where Scylla is. It's on all the maps, and there's no misidentifying it. So when, in 1974, when I went through, I said to myself, well, this must be Crib Dispute. I wonder why they never named it or put it on the maps. And kind of just, you know, percolated in the back of my mind for decades. And I looked around. I looked at all the maps. I couldn't find any reference to Crib Dispute, right? You looked in the gazetteers. I couldn't find any reference, at least the ones I was looking at. And eventually, in the age of the Internet, I did find reference to Crib Dispute. I just typed it in Google, and Crib Dispute came up, and there was like what's called a location card or information card about you know, this particular feature that had been identified and named in Grand Canyon, but never put on the maps. And so these cards I was finding were the original cards that the Board of Geographic Names was compiling to summarize the information about new topographic features when they named them. So it turns out that there was a formally named Crib Dispute. It just kind of got lost in the information and never made it onto the geological topographic maps. So we're not going to go too much into this story because it's a long rabbit hole. Eventually, you know, I realized, well, there is a formally named Crib Dispute. It just hasn't been plotted on the maps. And so looking at the U.S. geographic information about where this butte plotted, they actually plotted it on the west side of Tuna Creek. And,
oh, wow.
Yeah, and there is a hill there, and it's commonly called the Parachutist Hill.
Right.
Yes, and it's basically a hill. It's one of these slide blocks of red wall that, you know, forms a crumbly hill of a couple of boulders.
Right.
And this is where the Parachutists set up their camp when they bailed out of their I forget what kind of a plane it was in World War II.
Right.
Yeah, and before the rescue team could come down and get them out. And so, you know, this hikers go to this spot. Hikers that were interested can get to this spot with a couple days of work, you know, hiking. And it's kind of interesting to poke around in the old debris from their camp. And this, I think a lot of this stuff was taken out
right.
by Park Service.
Right.
But there's still materials there, canteens and stuff like that, you know. And it's interesting to poke around. But it's nowhere near Butte.
Right.
You know what I mean? And it's nowhere near imposing like Scylla Butte is on the south side of the river. So it's just conveniently there across from Scylla to the north, and I guess that's where the Board of Geographic Names people figured that, you know, that must be where Charybdis is located. Uh-huh. And so, but I said to myself, no, wait a minute, this is all wrong, you know, because Charybdis is the next, you know, it's a mile to the east on the other side of Tuna Creek, and it lines up perfectly on strike with, I shouldn't say on strike, but on the topographic lineaments, it lines up perfectly with Scylla across the river, and the two of them make a, you know, incontrovertible pair in my mind. So, you know, we're not going to go into the details about how Scylla and Charybdis are characters of mythology that Ulysses had to Odysseus had to encounter and deal with on his travails there. But it's Charybdis then has been etched in my mind. You can probably tell that by all the attention I'm giving to it in this discussion. But ever since I hiked underneath that thing in 74, I've been wanting to get back there. And so I talked Mark into coming down in May of 2018 to give this a shot.
Cool.
And so, we flew into Vancouver. I'm sorry, flew into Phoenix again, and we went and visited with Art and got a lot of equipment from him, and including ropes and extra ropes and whatnot, because I thought if it's way too hot up there for us, then we'll just stay on the rim and do technical summits off the rim where it's a lot cooler. And so we got all the gear sorted out, and then headed up to Marble Canyon, and that's where we spent the night before we headed out the next day. So then we got up in the morning and headed out towards Sublime Point to start the hike down. So we drove out there, and this was Mark's first trip in the canyon. So he had been there. Yeah, I can't recall now, but we had been there once before together when we tried to do Hutton. So, but it's his first time to Sublime Point, and so he wanted to see the geology out there and check out the tremendous topographic display, you know, that you have from there. And so we spent some time there, and then we went back on the road and parked the car, and then headed west across the drainage there, the Walla Valley drainages, to the rim. And I've been through here several times with Art and Bruce, this descent down to the Esplanade, and it's, each time it's a little bit of work to figure it out. But we got it eventually, and we stashed some water at the top because, you know, we wanted to make sure we had enough to get us out of the canyon and back to our car. And given the heat, it was very fortuitous that we did this. So we worked our way down through the Kaibab and Torweep, and there's some cliffs there that you have to negotiate. And then you get into the Coconino, and it's there's a little bit of climbing at the top, but then this beautiful gully that goes down. There was even some water in there, a little bit of flow. Yeah. But, you know, several times before when I had done this hike, I'd encountered a tremendous deer trail that goes up the talus of this slide all the way from the top ledges of the Esplanade sandstone all the way to, you know, to three-quarters of the way through the Coconino. And I was kind of expecting to encounter this trail that would really facilitate our passage, but it wasn't there. I mean, it certainly, you know, the animals had not been using it to the same extent. So we had to, you know, make do without it with lesser slopes, and it, which slowed us down a little bit, but nothing significantly. So, but eventually, we did get down through the talus there to the top at ledges of the Supai Esplanade, and then worked our way along those over to the Flint Tuna Saddle. So this was going to be our base here, and you know, you'd think after 35 or 40 years of doing this, I would be able to accurately forecast how long it's going to take to cover some ground. And I don't know what it is, whether I'm getting old, I'm losing that ability to figure that out, or I just don't have the physical capabilities anymore to handle what I imagine I can do in my brain. But we were moving slow, and partly it's because of the heat, too. So, but anyways, we got to the saddle there and dropped our gear, and it's late. By this time, we didn't want to go any farther, let's put it that way. So we figured, okay, at this point, we'll get camp here, and in the morning, we'll get up bright and early, and we'll head down, and we'll whip out, and we'll climb Charybdis, and we'll probably come back up in the evening with by headlamp, you know. Makes sense. It seemed like a good plan. So that was the plan, and the next morning we got up in the dark, and we started down, and I'd been through this, down this drainage in Tuna Creek three or four times, and every time I'd gone down, I thought it was a piece of cake. And, you know, each time I'd gone, whether it was solo or with Art and Bruce Scrubs, we'd managed to find the route, no problem. And this time, for some reason, each of the drop-offs in the Red Wall gave me problems.
Oh,
and
wow.
It was really puzzling, you know. It was concerning. It was frustrating because you're losing valuable time. And, you know, you're poking around looking for the right way, and you look over your shoulder, and the sun's another degree up above the horizon, and you know, you feel the temperature's gone up 2 degrees, and you know, it's kind of frustrating. And so, in any event, we continued, and we worked our way down. We did find all the bypasses, which are all on River Right, so the west side, the right side facing downstream, and several of them have water pockets right at the base of the falls or at the top of the drop off. So we were able to replenish our water, made sure we kept doing that. So eventually we got down through the Red Wall, but it was an hour and a half later than I'd expected.
Mm.
So that was kind of disconcerting. But we put our packs on and our climbing gear, and we headed down the bed of Tuna. And, you know, it's a nice slow walk, straightforward. There's no major drops or route finding. You just work your way down through the boulder patches. And eventually we got into the narrows, right, of the granite where the schist starts popping out. And you pick up water there. Some of it's kind of salty initially. But if you go down a little bit farther, you can find a really good flow. And so at this point, there's also really, really great exposure of the basal to peat sandstone, the Tapete sandstone formation sandstones with conglomerate that sits right on the schist. And you can see these big boulders of granite, Zoroaster granite and schist that are just, you know, sitting in this conglomerate right on the surface of the unconformity. It's just a tremendous geological site.
Huh.
And you know, I haven't seen that in too many places. There's a great exposure in Zoroaster Canyon of this same basal conglomerate with huge boulders, and I'm talking about three quarters of a meter in size, you know, of boulders of Zoroaster granite in there. And you know, we can talk about how those deposits form. It's you know, very interesting, but very interesting to see it, right, in place. And so Mark and I, both being geologists, spent a fair amount of time looking at this stuff.
Cool.
And so, yeah, so we decided we needed to spend some time recuperating in the cool, relative cool of Tuna Canyon there with the water, right? So
right.
We spent like a couple of hours, and we slept. And so by this time, you know, it was getting to be mid-afternoon, and the thinking was, all right, we're not going to get back to the rim, back to our camp.
Hmm.
At the Flint Tuna Saddle. So, but we can still get out to Charybdis, climb it, and then get back to this water, and have a comfortable night here by the water,
mm-hmm.
post climb. And so that became our plan, revised plan. So we headed out in the, you know, mid afternoon, and had to hike back upstream half a K or something to get to the break out of Tuna that allowed us to get back up to Pete's on the east side of Tuna.
Okay.
And so at this point we had to basically contour on the Tonto towards Charybdis Butte. Now Charybdis Butte, if you're not if you don't have a map in front of you, it's a butte that is a shale butte, Bright Angel Shale / Mauve Limestone, that's at the extreme south end of the ridge with Mencius and Confucius temples, okay?
Right.
So it's a very small little thing, but very significant in a few people's heads. And so, you know, we're plodding along on the tapetes there, and we've got the sun just bearing down on us, and there's no shade. And we're getting hotter and hotter and more frazzled. And eventually, we realize we're like a half a K short of Charybdis Butte, and it was like, you know, we're not even going to make it there and climb it before dark. So let's just bivouac here. So that's what we did. It was pretty much getting to be dark, and we just settled down on a comfortable little shale slope and made some little, you know, deer beds to nestle down into. And we took our climbing rack and climbing rope and made little pillows and things like that as best we could to get comfortable. And we just settled in to spend the night there. And you know, believe it or not, it was fairly comfortable. My recollection, I think it was just because I was so terribly beat, you know, from exhaustion. But I remember waking up a couple of times and looking over and seeing Mark just, you know, with his little, we each had a little like rain jacket to keep in case it rained, but, you know, using that for some warmth. And we just kind of made it through the night with a reasonable amount of rest and relaxation. So at least that was my experience. I don't remember what he said about it. But the next morning we got up and crack of dawn, and we were heading away because we wanted to obviously get this thing done as quickly as possible. And so we were heading away just at first light, and it took us still an hour to get to Charybdis.
Oh, wow.
And so we got there, and it's very imposing from the north. It's like 125, 140 feet of just vertical shale and Bright Angel Shale, and the west side is the same thing. But I'd spent hours, way, way too many hours, poring over Google Earth, looking at this thing on my computer. And I kind of thought, well, I think it's more broken on the east side, you know, but because of the topography, you never get a totally clear view,
right?
In Google Earth, but it did look more broken. So we were holding out hope that if we went around the corner to the east, we would encounter a more suitable slope, and that's exactly what we found, fortunately. So at this point, it was still, you know, the sun was. Hadn't broken the tops, hadn't come over the tops of the temples to the east, you know, like Ra and Osiris. I mean, we were still in the shade, thanks to those big buttes to the east. So we worked our way up this broken slope, talus, and it was, you know, it became clear that we were going to be within like 75 feet of the summit. You know, the slope would take us up pretty much all the way, and so it was a big relief to find that, because we knew at this point that this would not be a major climbing effort,
right?
To surmount, and
not
we had
like...
gear for that. You know, we had gear to help us up those 150 foot sheer vertical Bright Angel Shale cliffs if we had to, but. We had the gear to help us do that if we had tried to do it, but we didn't have to do that. So we get to the base of the obvious climb, and actually we're looking to figure out the best way to go. And I'm looking there with Mark, and we're scoping the upper cliffs, and I'm looking to the left towards the south, and I can see at the top of this beautiful crack system, this fantastic looking crack system, you know, but real technical. I can see this blue webbing hanging out, brilliant blue webbing hanging out at the top of the crack. And I thought, my first reaction was, oh, somebody beat us, because we were expecting a first ascent, right?
Uh-huh.
I said, somebody beat us to the first ascent of Charybdis Butte. And then I thought, well, look at the route that they picked. Why would they pick that? You know, it's a clean line, admittedly. It looks really good. But man, that looks super hard when there's these other options right above us to the right. So we just decided, well, we're gonna go for it, and we prepared our gear, and Mark led the first pitch, which is basically it's one pitch. So he led off, and it's very awkward because it's just totally rotten.
Right.
It's like a flared chimney, and you have to reach way inside of to get crumbly ledges that are just falling apart.
Right. It's hard to set protection. Climbing in the Bright Angel is dicey.
That's right. And so, you know, he had to go up like 12 feet before he could get something in.
Jeez.
Way in the back and some sort of a cam. So he managed it all and then climbed up at, you know, it's like 40 feet, something like that, this crack. And then you get to a kind of a platform. And from there, it's broken ledges and short cliffs up to the actual summit block. So it's very, you know, it's essentially a 40-foot climb. But very rotten and creepy, you know. And like, he's climbing this thing, and there's crap falling all over me, you know. Fortunately, we had helmets and everything, and you know, I was belaying him, but anyways, he gets up to the top, and I hear him yell out, belay off, and so then I, you know, had to second the pitch and clean it, and I took a lot of tension right off the start just to get off the ground, but eventually I managed to get going, I had to leave one of the pieces that the first piece he had set, the cam, because I could not reach it and figure it out, figure out how to remove it. So, which was kind of, you know, disheartening, but this stuff is not cheap.
Yeah.
And then I managed to get up the top of the climb and came out on the summit. At that point, I had never felt so knackered, you know.
Wow.
Because we were low on water. It was probably well over 100 degrees already, and it was just we bivouacked the night before. I was really extended, you know. Mark's a big guy, and he's very strong, and he knew what had to be done here to keep going, to keep our, you know, efforts successful.
Mm-hmm.
So he realized the first thing we got to do is figure out how to get off this place.
Right.
And because we didn't see any, there's no bushes you could tie to or run your rope around or anything like that.
Huh.
So he started to build a 2 foot or 3 foot pyramid of talus blocks.
Okay.
That we could then put a runner around and use that, you know, that weight to use as a rappel anchor. So, and while he was working on that, you know, lifting these big blocks and building a pyramid, I went and found this little tiny crack. It was the upper part of a chimney that was, you know, on the west. It's a west side of the summit chimney.
Ooh, where there's some shade.
Where there's a little tiny bit of shade, but you know, I was thinking to myself, this is probably not the best place for a person who's so extended to be sitting, you know. And so I was very cognizant of that, you know. But I sucked down that shade as much as I could, and eventually the sun was up, and this was all like 25 minutes, right? But it allowed me to recover a little bit, and then he told me, look, just go over to the summit and check it out, right?
Hmm.
And I'll finish this up, and so I did, and the first thing I see is all this shit from Bradford Washburn.
Oh my!
It was such a letdown because, you know, we thought we had the first ascent, and I don't think that. And then we saw this webbing, and we thought, oh no, what's going on here? And then there's this material from Washburn. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't as bad as we found on Raw, 25 years before that. But it was still there, and there was a big cairn, and there was some junk, some boards and stuff. So Mark comes traipsing over from where, you know, the route had come up to the summit, to the top, and he says, what's all this? And I explained to him about the Washburn survey. I said, I don't think these guys climbed up here. I think they just landed their helicopter. And in fact, you could still see the two skid marks from where they had landed their helicopter. I'm assuming it's Washburn's helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I don't think the Park Service would have any reason to go land up there, right?
Right.
In the intervening 40 years.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, so we figured it was Washburn, and so we're still thinking, but there's no climbers, Karen, you know? And so, hey, maybe we are the first. And we poked all around. We couldn't find any climbers, Karen. And so so we started thinking, well, maybe, you know, I don't know what that was in that webbing is doing over there, but maybe nobody else has been up here. And that's kind of what we decided. And so we had a register that we left, you know, an ArtLight register. And I think I wrote in the register that the true location of Charybdis Butte, right, as opposed
nice.
To just Charybdis Butte with the elevation, I would say the true location of Charybdis Butte. And so, anyways, we didn't spend a whole lot of time there because there's no protection from the sun, and we knew we had to get going.
Right.
So we quickly, you know, retreated back to the rappel. Mark went down first, and his anchor was perfect, and fortunately, he was able to retrieve the nut that I had to leave behind. So that was a positive thing. And so then I came down on the rappel, and we packed everything up and started back for our camp. And it's, with the heat, it's kind of anticlimactic, I have to say. So it was just like rather than being able to revel in. And in the that's right, I forgot. By the time we got down to the at the base of the rappel, you know, I just happened to glance up to the left at those twin cracks that were the site of that supposed first ascent line with the blue webbing. And I looked again, and I realized that this brilliant patch of blue was actually a keyhole through the limestone.
Oh wow!
Bright blue sunshine, a sky. Coming through.
Oh my gosh.
It wasn't a piece of webbing at all, right? So it was like, oh wow, that's great, because now we have, you know, now we know we're the first ascent. There's no record of anybody having been up there.
Yeah.
And there's no detritus, climber's detritus hanging around, like, you know, slings and from rappels or protection or whatever. So that was pretty exciting to see that. And but nonetheless, we still had to get back out of there and you know, we had to reverse that hiking along the Tonto back into Tuna Creek, and it was really tedious because it was getting really hot, and we were out of water. You know, we had a couple of granola bars or something like that, but we had been planning to get back to our pack the day before. You know, that evening, the night before, so. So we weren't really prepared for this. So fortunately, though, we made our way back, taking our time and doing it slow, and got to the water, which was a godsend. So we actually, from where you get down to the creek, we had to walk down canyon a short distance to get to the water and the shade. More importantly, the shade of the canyon, right? So. But it was what a godsend. We spent like 4 hours there just sleeping.
I bet.
in this canyon with the trickle of the water, you know, and the shade there. Just a little
nice
tiny
and cool.
bit of shade, but
yeah.
enough.
But
you
enough.
Know, you settle into the gravel and it was such and once we got to spend that time there and could relax and cool down and recharged a little bit, then, you know, it became a little bit more of an exciting adventure and satisfying adventure. So
yeah.
We still had a long way to go, though. So
right.
So we did start up in the afternoon. We gathered our wits together, filled up our water bottles, and headed up slowly up the creek there, and found our way back to the Red Wall drops. And the middle one, Mark wound up, he just decided, he says, I'm just going to free climb this. And I said, well, if you do, please trail a rope. Which he did. And I'm happy that he did, right? Because it was a little bit more than I would have liked to free solo. So, so we did do that, and that sped things up a little bit. But he slowly pulled ahead of me going up the final stretch there through the Supai slide.
Right.
And, And at the top, we both basically had to get our headlamps out to make the final, few hundred feet there. And I think he beat me to the Flint Tuna Saddle by about 20 minutes. But it turns out that the crows had kind of hit our campsite during the day.
Oh, wow.
And they, kind of ravaged it in many respects. I some of the food that we had was actually opened up, and I don't know how they got into there, but in any event, it was a little bit of a mess, and so we had to clean that up mostly the next morning because it was dark. We couldn't really see that well outside.
So, Jim, I've heard that condors can actually, with their huge, big, sharp beaks, tear their ways into packs. Do you think it could have been condors?
Well, I hadn't actually thought about that. There was some pack damage. It wasn't major damage.
Okay.
It wasn't like a pack ripped apart, but there was like some exploited edges.
Hmm.
And so I hadn't actually thought of a condor, but that's not out of the question, I would think, So, yeah, it could be.
Okay.
I'll have to ask Mark what his recollection of that is, because it could be that, he had more damage on his pack than I recollect. So, interesting theory, though. Yeah,
don't know.
Well, anyways, so we got up there, and we weren't going to go any farther, obviously, because it's dark and we're
right.
Just exhausted. So we camped there that night, and but still, we hadn't recovered to the point where we could partake of a sip out of the little flask of whiskey that Art had sent along with us for a celebration. And we were just not recovered enough to be able to handle that whiskey. So we didn't pull that out that evening. But the next morning we got up and then pulled everything together and headed back for the rim, and it's pretty uneventful except it took us longer than we expected. And then we got to the rim, and we had our water waiting for us. That was nice. Although once we got back to the bed of tuna after having climbed Charybdis, water was not a problem because there was water in the potholes in the red wall, and there was some. That seep in the Coconino Gully, etc. So, but it's always nice to have a pint sitting there under a tree, when you get to the rim. So yeah, we just headed back, and at that point, from the vehicle on, we had to negotiate the road there, the Point Sublime Trail, and I remember we had a Nissan Rogue, the same, a similar. We'd had one of these before, I believe, and I felt fairly confident because it was pretty high clearance with 4x4 capacity. But once we got up onto the Crystal Ridge, I remember before we actually got to the bad point on the ridge where you go over the top of the ridge, we actually got into a place where I thought we couldn't go backwards if we had to. And so we're in a situation now, we're on this road where we're going in one direction. We don't think we can return the other way we came, and we don't know if we can handle the objective hazard ahead, right? So anyways, it's just like a tense couple moments until you finally do the driving and you negotiate it, and it all went fine. The Crystal Ridge was not the actual ridge was not the worst part of the drive this particular year. So we negotiated it and just fine and went into town or into the village. And we kind of cleaned up there and had some food. At that point we were pretty satisfied with ourselves for the day. That would have been my 101st summit, right? It was a very rewarding experience because
yeah.
I'd wanted to do this climb for many, many years, and it was essentially the last unnamed summit outside of Gray Castle in Marble Canyon, which Jake Daly did just last year. And
right.
So although Gray Castle's been on the maps, Charybdis hasn't, and we aim to change that. We'll get it put onto the maps eventually.
Cool.
But But yeah, and just to finish up, the next day we spent the night on the rim there, and relaxed. And when we got in the cool woods under the ponderosas and had everything of our, you know, all of our camp finery laid out around us, we actually had a couple of sips of that whiskey.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, that was a very fitting end to the to that day. And so the next day after that, you know, Mark and I did the village sightseeing, and I also took him out to Cape Royal to look at the views.
Nice.
From out there.
Yep.
And then we also went and climbed the highest summit of Tridal Peak, which is just a little summit off of Roosevelt Point on the north rim there. So it was a lot of fun and very satisfying. And so then we started the long trip down, and ironically, we went and visited with my mother at the end of that day. We drove back to Phoenix, right? And we visited with my mother, and I dropped some gear there. And so she and Mark got to talk quite a bit, and she met my new climbing partner, and she was very, very impressed with him because he's a very level-headed guy. And and he was impressed with her too because she was a very smart woman. And then we had a couple of days together in Phoenix before we split and went our different ways because he lives in Ontario. But ironically, my mother passed away like 3 weeks later.
Oh, wow.
And so he got to meet her, and she was in the greatest of health, right? And that's the last time I saw her too, right? Mm-hmm. Well, shouldn't say that because I was with her at her bedside when she passed away. But the last time I saw her in good health.
Wow.
So it was kind of a poignant end. In retrospect to that trip, right? Mm-hmm. And I mentioned earlier about how sometimes, you know, you place a trip into its historical context on the basis of other experiences that were happening at the time.
Right.
And I knew that the Charybdis Butte climb had happened just in proximity to my mother's passing. But there was no reference to that in the notes. Well, obviously it's because it was 3 weeks later, you know.
Right.
But anyways, it's just a kind of a reminder of how time paces everything we do, you
yes.
know. And it moves along, you know, whether you're hiking and climbing or not.
That's right.
The time passes. So, yeah. So cool. A really good a good hike, and climb. And just tremendously satisfying for me as a long-term hiker and climber in the canyon to get this summit. So
awesome!
Yeah, yeah.
Very fun.
That's not the end of our hiking, though. So.
No, it's not. And I'm sure we'll do more. But we should probably wrap up this part then.
Yeah, hopefully it didn't go too long. So.
No. But is there anything else you want to bring into this, or do we?
I think that's it for the time being. You know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. Well, with that. Let's conclude part 34 of Grand Canyon Oral History with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, September 11th, 2022. My name is Tom Martin. And Jim, thank you so very much.
Well, thank you, Tom. It's always an honor to be able to do this.
It's a two-way street.